thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. An order restricting use of force by immigration agents in Chicago is halted. Many Chicago homeowners are facing higher property tax bills. We hear from the Cook County assessor on what's pushing the hike.
I was stripped of my dignity.
And two disturbing videos of black women in labor circulating social media, reviving the conversation about black maternal health. First off tonight, a federal judge's sweeping order restricting federal agents' use of force during immigration raids in the Chicago area has been paused for now. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals agreed to halt the order issued by District Judge Sarah Ellis while court proceedings continue. Ellis issued the preliminary injunction earlier this month following a series of aggressive raids, with witnesses testifying to being hit with pepper balls or tear gas and having firearms pointed at them without provocation. Since Ellis's injunction was imposed, many federal immigration agents have left Chicago and begun operations elsewhere. The appeals court says it intends to set an expedited schedule for its proceedings and left the door open that a more tailored injunction could be found appropriate. Federal terrorism charges have been filed against the Chicago man accused of lighting a woman on fire on a Blue Line train this week. According to the complaint, 50-year-old Lawrence Reed entered the train at 9:04 p.m. Monday, shortly after filling a small container with gasoline at a gas station. Later, surveillance footage allegedly shows Reed walking up to the 26-year-old victim and pouring the liquid over her head and body.
The victim was riding northbound, approaching the Clark and Lake subway stop in the Loop, minding her own business and reading her phone, when the defendant doused her with gasoline and lit her on fire. When the train stopped and the victim was able to muster the strength to stumble on the platform, two good Samaritans put out the flames.
The suspect, who has previous criminal charges, was arrested the next morning with fire-related injuries to his hand. The charges could result in a life sentence or death if the victim dies. She's been hospitalized with critical injuries. The family of Dexter Reed is asking a federal judge to reinstate their lawsuit against the city over the death of the 26-year-old killed while exchanging gunfire with Chicago police officers last year. When Judge Jeffrey Cummings closed the case a year ago, he indicated he'd reopen it and schedule a trial if city council did not approve a settlement. Well, city council didn't, even though Chicago's Corporation Council recommended resolving the case for $1.25 million. City attorneys will now have to convince a jury that four of the police officers involved did nothing wrong when they fired 96 shots at Reed, striking him 13 times. The Cook County State's attorney concluded that Reed himself fired a total of 11 shots before he died when determining that the cops would not face charges. Two Chicagoans met today in Vatican City. Their names are Pope Leo XVI and Governor J.B. Pritzker. The governor, who is of Jewish faith, said, quote, "Pope Leo XVI's message of hope, compassion, unity, and peace resonates with Illinoisans of all faiths and traditions." Pritzker and Illinois First Lady M.K. brought a few gifts, including art made by women incarcerated at Logan Correctional Facility, a pair of books, and a pack of beer, Burning Bush Brewery's De Pope American Mild Ale. The Pritzkers invited the Pope back for a hometown visit whenever he'd like. Up next, what's behind soaring property taxes for some Cook County residents? Right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Pope Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Homeowners are searching for answers as they grapple with hefty and tardy property tax bills. A new report from the Cook County Treasurer's Office says declining values for downtown commercial properties are shifting the tax burden onto homeowners. Cook County Assessor Fritz Kagi argues the property tax system favors corporations and says he's pushing for change. Joining us to talk about this is the assessor himself, Fritz Kagi. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Brandis.
So as we just mentioned, we keep hearing that the explanation is that the valuations for commercial properties have fallen, thus sort of tipping the seesaw increase the valuations for residential properties. Help us understand how that calculates.
Well, that's true as far as it goes. So when we finished our reassessment of Chicago, homeowners would have had actually 2 percentage points less of the burden than they started with, because we saw residential values going up, but we saw commercial values being higher than where they had been in the last reassessment, which was right after the pandemic. But they were cut, these values were cut at the Board of Review by nearly 20% for commercial properties, whereas only for 1% for residential properties. And that shifted about $500 million of the burden, according to the treasurer, onto homeowners. That's about $700 that's tacked onto the tax bill of every single home in Chicago. And in some of the neighborhoods where we're seeing big increases, this accounts for more than half of the increase.
So instead of, you said when you initially started, it would have been about 2%, but now the treasurer is saying it's about 30%. The median, I think, is about 30% across the city.
The median increase in people's bill was 16%, according to the treasurer, but that was on homeowners. Commercial bills hardly changed at all, and the typical commercial bill downtown fell 28%. So the question is this appropriate? Now, the county made a study of commercial properties and their sales over the last several years after the pandemic, and it's found that the Board Review has cut commercial properties a 25% low in 2 out of those 3 years. Too low in 2 out of those 3 years, meaning that there's too much burden that's been shifted on the homeowners in the past. And I'm worried that this has happened again, because I hear the same stories that you've heard, Brandis, about how people are suffering. They're shocked by the increase in these bills that are already stacked on top of insurance, electricity, health care, all the other elements of inflation that affect people, especially affects people who work, because seniors who have the senior freeze are protected from these increases that allow them to stay in place. But people who work don't have some of these protections, and we need to think about what we can do for them.
So you mentioned that some neighborhoods in particular are experiencing the worst of it. Some South and West Side residents have seen their tax bill go up significantly. Property taxes for homeowners went up by 133% in West Garfield Park, 99% in North Lawndale, compared to barely 6% in Lincoln Park. How is it that this increase then is falling disproportionately on communities whose median home values are so much lower than those in Lincoln Park?
This really goes back to affordability. So in some South and West Side neighborhoods, areas where homes used to sell in the 100,000 range, 150,000 range, they're selling now in the $250,000 range. For example, West Garfield Park, North Lawndale, and Austin. So when you have those kinds of increases, that can lead people's bills to be rising. But why are the prices rising in these neighborhoods? It's because people who are searching for homes, who are making maybe $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year, they can't afford to buy a home on the north side. They're priced out. So they've been looking in South and West Side neighborhoods and have been driving up the most affordable prices, the prices for the most affordable homes. So that's the driver that's happening here. But what really disturbs me is that these increases need not have been so big, about $700 per home is tagged onto them, because of the cuts that have been made on commercial properties, which we suspect are too excessive on commercial properties. And it's not just office buildings. This is on hotels. This is on data centers. This is on retail properties, industrial properties that are in apartments that are doing pretty well.
And so there's the cuts that are happening at the Board of Review on those commercial properties. But for as far as the increases in some South and West Side neighborhoods, West Garfield Park, et cetera, how much of those increases are driven by improvements in those neighborhoods and growth?
I think it's a lot of things. First of all, there are really great things happening in our neighborhoods. And the people who have stuck it out through the doldrums of the housing crisis that happened in the late 2000s, the 20-teens, they were pummeled by falling prices. Their mortgages were underwater, but a lot of people stuck it out and have taken good care of their neighborhoods. When you look at Austin, when you look at Garfield Park, when you look at North Lawndale, people have a lot of pride in their neighborhood, and they have taken care of it. And They're now getting a return on their investment. So the last 3 years on the South and West sides, there's been more wealth creation in the growth of values of people's homes than over the last 20 years. So that's good news. Of course, it's hard when people's bills go up. What makes, you know, and everyone, you know, needs to be paying their fair share, of course. But when we're seeing big cuts on commercial properties, on big industrial properties, commercial properties, corporate properties, and it's pushed onto the homeowner, when past studies have shown that these cuts have been excessive, that is what I find extremely concerning, and that's what I'm fighting against.
So there's the tax bill and there's the assessed value, of course. The Treasurer's report released earlier this week also found that West Garfield Park, North Lawndale residents saw their property value assessments more than double.
That's right.
What's the cause there?
Well, again, this is affordability. So imagine in Austin a few years ago before the pandemic, you could buy a house in the maybe below $150,000. It's very hard to find a home in Austin below $250,000 now. And the reason is Austin is a great neighborhood. Great things are happening there. They have great, there's a revival in the commercial strips there. The homes are really nice. And people who are looking at homes are looking all over the city for affordability. If you're someone who's making $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 and you're priced out, completely out of buying a home on the north side, and if you've been in an apartment where rents are rising, maybe stuck there during the pandemic,
maybe
you're going to pay up.
A home in Austin.
Right. You're
going to
pay up a little bit for houses in all these neighborhoods across the city, which are great. The key is to make sure that people's assessment is estimated accurately. We have to follow the prices that people are paying out there. That's our duty at our office. But we want to make sure that we get that right. We try to walk humbly. So we can go through a checklist about what homeowners can do to make sure that they're not paying more than they have to.
You say your office is advocating for a circuit breaker to relieve homeowners. What is that? What would it look like?
That's right. So a circuit breaker program is a kind of property tax relief program for people whose bills have spiked. 29 other states have programs like this. I've scoured the nation meeting with our peers to see how those can work. And it's really important because this is the kind of relief that would help people in neighborhoods that are experiencing gentrification, like the kind that we talked about, for seniors who are falling off the senior freeze, and for working people. We need to have more protections for people who work, and we don't have enough of them. So how would the circuit breaker work? The program that we proposed would be if your bill spiked 25% or more, you would get relief for up to half of the increase in your bill for 3 years. And there would be an income test. Your income would have to be below $100,000 is our proposal. And I've written an op-ed with the leading mayors in the West and South suburbs who have high tax rates, whose taxpayers have experienced problems just like this the last couple of years, and has the support of the Southland mayors and managers and the Southland Regional Mayoral Black Caucus.
What's been the reception from lawmakers so far?
Well, what we hear is that budgets are extremely stretched in Springfield, but we hear from legislators that there's a lot of need. What we've heard from leaders is that let's try to make a program that can work statewide so it's not just Cook County. So we're going to be working and designing legislation just like that and introduce it in the spring.
And real quick, before we let you go, we've talked a lot about the Board of Review, have not heard from them in time for this segment tonight. But how would you argue for different calculations once those appeals are made to the Board of Review so that commercial properties are accurately valued?
Well, the good thing is that there's a roadmap that a county study group made so that that we'll get more accurate assessments from the outset, and there'll be fewer cuts on appeal, so there'll be less burdens, they'll be passed on to homeowners, these assessments will be more accurate. There's more than a dozen recommendations. It's led by a study group led by President Preckwinkle. We've already started implementing these. We agree with them wholeheartedly, and the Board of Review is working with us to implement them as well. So we look forward to further progress in implementing them.
All right. Cook County Tax Assessor Fritz Kagi, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Up next, a shocking incident at a local hospital highlights challenges to Black maternal health. demands for action after a black mother in labor is discharged from an Indiana hospital and gives birth in a car just 8 minutes later. The Chicago area mother, Mercedes Wells, spent hours at the hospital until her contractions were a minute apart before she was told she was being discharged.
So we got to transfer her to a different hospital while she's in labor, in pain.
Anyone who's ever been in labor knows Wells had her baby in a car on her way to another hospital, but says the baby girl is doing well now. It comes just days after another high-profile case in Texas, where viral video showed Carrie Jones in visible pain answering numerous questions before getting a delivery room. The cases are raising questions over the treatment of black pregnant women and renewing conversations over medical racism. Joining us now are Chez Smith, founder of Girls in the Hood, an organization dedicated to providing young black girls and women with reproductive health care and resources. Carrie Stewart, a certified nurse midwife with the UI Health and founder of Melanated Midwives. And Blair Imani, author and creator of the TikTok series Smarter in Seconds. She's also a commentator on issues of structural racism and is currently pregnant. Congratulations on that, Blair. Thanks to all of you for joining us. First, I want to get your reaction when you saw these videos circulating. There's Carrie Jones in Texas and the Wells family here in Indiana. Chez Smith, first over to you. What was your reaction when you saw those?
Disgust. That was my first reaction. I honestly could not watch the video in its full segment. I had to keep coming back to it in parts because it was so triggering, you know, as a mother, as a black mother, and just as a woman, period, you know, to see someone in that type of situation, in that pain. So I would say that I was disgusted, but I wasn't surprised.
Not surprised. Okay, yeah. I want to come back to that. Carrie Stewart, what was your reaction?
You know, unfortunately, I have to agree with Chez. Very disgusted, quite disappointed, and, you know, just traumatized myself as a black woman, as a mom. And I could not watch the entire thing myself, because as you can see, as you start to look at it, you notice this is what's going to happen. And so, again, just very disappointed that these two young women had to experience those situations.
Blair Imani?
I have to echo both because it's just so terrifying, you know, being 9 months pregnant myself, you know, I'm ready to give birth any moment, and the entirety of my pregnancy, the maternal mortality rate and systemic racism have been top of mind. And so to see the worst case scenario play out, not just once, but twice on video in full resolution, is just really just... It makes you want to shudder. It makes you cringe. It makes you afraid. But I also, you know, I'm leaning into my support system. My OBGYN on our last appointment brought it up before I did because she knows what her black patients are going through. And it's really just unacceptable. It's reprehensible. It is disgusting and disappointing.
Chez, you say you weren't surprised.
Oh, no.
Why not?
Yeah. I mean, this is what black women have been screaming forever. Right, for decades, that our concerns are dismissed, our pain is dismissed, it's not taken seriously, and as we saw, that woman was invisible pain, right? And so, yeah, we've been saying this for the longest, and so while I hate that it was amplified in this manner, I'm glad that it is raising the awareness that we need to hopefully, you know, come up with some solutions to this situation, but... Yeah, I wasn't surprised at all. This is what we've been saying.
And to that point, though, this feels like an issue that we've been talking about publicly. Not, you know, obviously these women have been talking about it for some time, but publicly for the last several years, Carrie, why does this seem to have not improved?
Because providers and institutions are not being intentional on caring for people in their community. And so, you know, I said this earlier today, talking to one of my colleagues, yes, we have protocols. Yes, everybody's not going to fit into that situation. But everybody labors differently. She's not hollering. She's not screaming. That does not mean her pain is at a 10, at a 12. And so you need to use common sense to know that that young lady did not need to be discharged, especially if this is her fourth child. We know as providers that someone can go from three to complete in a matter of 8 minutes, as we saw. And so I think we're just not... You know, as much as, you know, everybody likes to say, listen, 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 they're listening. They're not acting appropriately. And that's the problem.
Most recent figures show that while maternal mortality nationwide has declined since its peak in 2022, black women are still more likely to die in childbirth. 50 deaths per 100,000 live births compared to 14.5 deaths per 100,000 live births for white women. Blair Imani, what do we know about the causes for these disparities?
You know, when we look at these different outcomes for different communities, sometimes we can subconsciously think, oh, well, that must be because, you know, hypertension is more common in the community or this illness is more common. When it comes to the Black maternal mortality rate, I'm sad to say that it is because of systemic racism, it is because of medical racism, it is because of systemic bias. It's because we have medical students who are being taught as recently as 2020 that Black people have thicker skin or that we don't have as high pain tolerance. Things that are rooted in complete pseudoscience, but are still being, you know, taught as fact. And it goes all the way back to Marion J. Sims and the creation of gynecology as a healthcare system. But what we see again and again is that this isn't something that is specific to a specific education bracket. It's not specific to an income bracket. It is something that all Black women are dealing with, and Indigenous women as well are dealing with it. They're two times more likely to pass due to pregnancy-related causes as well.
Chez, you work with young Black women and teens in pregnancy. What are some of the challenges in getting them the support and care they need?
Oh, it's so bad for our girls. You know, they are facing stigma and judgment just right off the bat, right, for being a teen mom or being, a young parent. And so when they're encountering the healthcare system, that just goes, it's so bad. We get calls from girls who are crying, who are in tears, and, you know, they're saying, oh, they're so mean to me here. So from the point of entry, from registration to triage to by the time they get to the provider, they're so beat up, their spirits are so broken, right? And I want people to understand that, one, it's not your business on, you know, how someone got pregnant or why they're pregnant at their age and things like that. That's number one. Number two, sometimes things happen because of sexual assault, sexual abuse and things like that. And imagine how you're making that situation worse for our girls. And so at Girls in the Hood Foundation, we often will just jump in the hood mobile and go to the clinic appointments with the girls to advocate for them. We already send them with little notebooks so that they can, you know, take notes and write down providers' names and things like that. But we're really hands-on with them to try to soften those blows.
Carrie, tell us a little bit about the work of Melanated Midwives briefly and the kind of supports that you all aim to provide to lower Black maternal mortality.
We're really trying to aim for diversification of the workforce. And we know that we need more providers that look like the individuals that they care for in the community. We know that, unfortunately, some of the DEI measures have, you know, been barriers for us to do so. But we're still boots on the ground and trying to get folks educated about midwives and other healthcare providers that they could do as a career choice. And so if that means we're providing resources such as scholarships and internships, but also just doing more education in the community for our families about how to select the right institution, how to select the right provider, what things you can do to advocate for yourself. And these women were advocating for themselves, and it's very hard to do so when you're in labor. So having a good support system to be able to advocate, getting a doula, considering midwifery care, and knowing that there are other options and other places that you can go that are providing care that is supportive of your needs and your wishes.
Now, we should mention we do have an official statement from Franciscan Health, which is where the Wells family initially went, that says that they have found the concerns deeply troubling and that they are, quote, committed to meeting and exceeding all regulations and best practices for care, and we will take appropriate action based on the findings of our review. They say they'll be conducting a thorough investigation. Blair Imani, we've got under a minute left. What is that enough? What needs to change here?
We need an entire systems change. We need more embrace of midwifery care. We need more embrace of doula care. We need that to be more accessible. We also have an extremely hostile administration in this moment, which is spreading misinformation about guidance for pregnant people about things like what pain relief we're allowed to use. And so this is the worst time. But because of organizations like Girls in the Hood, like Melanated Midwives, like Birth Fund, like Black Mamas Matter Alliance, this is improving. It's really the community stepping up and showing up for one another, lifting as we climb. And we know that we will get through these difficult times through the support of one another, as we always have. But it's going to take a while to see more systems change. But we have to continue to speak up, and we can't just do it when something goes viral. So if this was an awakening moment for many people, I hope that continues.
All right, that's where we'll have to leave it. Best of luck for wishing you a safe and joyful delivery. Blair Imani, Chez Smith, Carrie Stewart, thanks to you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brandon.
And we're back right after this.
Reflecting the people and perspectives that make up our communities, this story is part of Chicago Tonight, Black Voices.
And that's our show for this Wednesday night. Join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 11. One-on-one with surprise congressional candidate Patty Garcia, who's vying to succeed the retiring Chuy Garcia. No relation. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, wishing all a happy and healthy holiday season.